From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today, we'll explore some of the challenges of hiring and retaining corrections officers at Wisconsin prisons. Then we'll learn what's being done locally to prioritize healing from trauma after an injury caused by violence.
We have to remember that, you know, patients can have long-term disabilities, whether it's physical or mental, and we have to be responsible for ensuring that our patients recover to the best of their ability.
Plus, we'll learn about some of the best summer dining destinations, including one Milwaukee summer staple, sausage.
If you live in Milwaukee and you don't eat sausage, then you have not truly lived.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. Today, we'll tell you about some of the best taco trucks in the city and learn where to try some of Milwaukee's best sausage. But we'll start with this. The investigation into Waupun Correctional Institute is still ongoing. The warden and 8 correction officers have been charged after 4 deaths at the prison. They happened while the prison was in a lockdown that lasted for months. One of the reasons the prison gave for the lockdown was a lack of staffing. And one part of this investigation that hasn't been explored as much is the role of correctional officers. Wanda Bertram of the Prison Policy Initiative has looked into some of the challenges of hiring and retaining prison staff. She joins Lake Effect's Jimmy Gutierrez to share what she's found.
Well, the big news out of Waupun that people who aren't in Wisconsin, you know, will have more likely heard, and I think where my colleagues and I first went, whoa, is the fact that there was a lockdown there that went on for at least a year, right? Or several months, if not a year. And then a warden and ACOs have been charged with felony misconduct for their role in deaths that occurred during these lockdowns. I know that a lot of the authorities involved are trying to keep the deaths and the lockdowns separate, but this is, you know, for people who are outside of Wisconsin, you know, this is the story that we're hearing. If I can kind of draw a distinction, it was shocking without being surprising to hear about the lockdowns, because there's been some reporting on this, but extended lockdowns for the general prison population have been an increasing phenomenon across the country, in federal prisons and in state prisons. So not just at Waupun and not just in Wisconsin. You know, this is going on in concert with a lot of other policies that we're seeing that are making prison life increasingly isolating, like prisons and jails banning in-person visits or banning physical mail, which Wisconsin has also done. And when we heard about this, it strikes a chord, because the framing that the DOC did around this issue was, we're understaffed. Right? We're understaffed, so we have to put the population on lockdown. And it's disturbing to us, and I think should be disturbing to everyone. You don't have to be a policy think tank to have this reaction, that the DOC would do this without considering, it seems like, any other options, whether that's, you know, intensified efforts to hire more staff, or even sort of low-hanging fruit efforts to release more people from prison. So yeah, those were the first impressions that we had.
Some big first impressions. And you talked about the lockdowns, which was pretty widely reported here in state after the deaths of 4 prisoners inside of the facility, which then brought, as you said, the charges against the warden, against the COs, the state promising to do more. There's also local, state, and federal investigations currently happening. With a response like this, how do you expect the state to kind of position itself in conversations to say that this is how we're going to move forward and this is how we plan on remedying the situation?
I mean, that's a good question. And I think that one of the things that we're already hearing that, you know, when I heard it, I thought, of course, you know, of course, this is what they're saying, is that the lockdowns had nothing to do with the deaths, right? That these deaths were, you know, the result of misconduct by staff. This was related to improper care of people who were having a medical issue, not enough monitoring of people on suicide watch, what have you. And they're trying to separate this from, you know, the kinds of conditions that a lockdown can inflict on people. I'm very dubious of that. And then the other thing that we can expect to hear is that this was about understaffing. You've already seen the state kind of do this, thread this needle quite interestingly, where they say the deaths were not about the lockdowns, but also the lockdowns are really bad. And the lockdowns were caused by understaffing. What they're trying to imply is that once we hire some more staff, then all these problems are going to go away, which, you know, doesn't square with the fact that, as it's been reported at the beginning of the lockdown, administrators said that this was about bad behavior by prisoners. So there's an inconsistent story that's coming from the state about why these lockdowns happened.
What I would love to just spend a minute with is you all at the Prison Policy Initiative had spent some time going through the data on COs, correctional officers, people right. who are working inside of prisons, and kind of just the toll that that job puts on a person as well. And I'm just curious, what did you all find going through that data and that collection of data?
There haven't been tons of national studies on COs, but there have been a lot of state-based studies. One of the few national studies that has been that's been done of almost 4,000 corrections professionals from all over the country found that about a third of people in security roles in prisons and jails have PTSD, and about the same number have depression. That's been echoed in state-level studies. Like, for instance, there was a California study that, you know, found that about 30% quote-unquote experienced repeated disturbing memories, 48% felt anxious, nervous, or on edge. And then there was another study that was done in the Northeast that almost half of all correction staff reported experiencing or witnessing a coworker's suicide. Over half reported experiencing or witnessing the suicide of an incarcerated person. It just gives a sense of how difficult these jobs can be. And when I say difficult, I don't mean, oh, we should be, you know, we should be so proud of them for the work that they're doing. I mean, we should be taking these experiences as a reason to question the prison environment and why we impose this on so many people and why this is such a staple of American life.
There's been a pretty concerted push within the state and a pretty large marketing campaign to bring people into the profession. And that's a silver bullet that I've heard is like, you need to hire more staff to get this kind of equilibrium. And I'm just curious, besides all of the things that you have said, why is it so hard to hire COs and to keep up with that equilibrium?
First of all, we're coming out of the COVID-19 pandemic, right? Which is a time that's a period that saw a lot of people in prisons and jails quit their jobs and not come back because it was such a horrific thing to experience, watching people, both coworkers and incarcerated people, get sick or come in when they themselves might be sick. I think pushed a lot of people to burnout. And so I think it's harder in the wake of COVID-19 for facilities to hire. You know, I also want to note that if the state of Wisconsin is incarcerating more and more people, then it's going to have a hard time keeping the staff to incarcerated people ratios where they should be, right? There's two sides to this ratio question, to this equation, right? It's, are you hiring enough people to supervise the population? And also, are you making a concerted effort to not crowd your prisons?
Right. And that's a distinction that we have as one of the highest incarceration rates in the country, as well as I think it's top three as far as racial disparities when it comes to the people that we incarcerate. You know, we're talking about stress and burnout and all these things that leads to these unsafe working conditions. And I don't want to glaze over the fact that COs are also perpetrators of violence and trauma and harm. As we saw in Waupun, where multiple COs have lost their jobs, and I believe it's the number may be close to 20 that are still being investigated.
I mean, I'm glad that you're nodding to this. I mean, a lot of the violence behind bars, and we know that prisons and jails are violent environments, a lot of the violence is perpetrated by COs themselves. There is actually a sociological theory that's been proposed around this, which is called violence. The idea that police, military, and people employed in security in general are violence workers. That's the main, you know, that's the main expertise that they're required to have in order to do their jobs. That is something that we found that among corrections officers actually has an impact on their lives. You know, being trained in meeting out violence has an impact on people's home lives. It's part of the reason why COs have higher rates of domestic violence at home. I don't think that's something that you can train people out of, right? I think this is a really key part of the prison environment. It's, you know, sort of analogous to, as we've seen, police officers, you know, receiving warrior cop training, right? The idea that you're at war with the people that you are also supposed to serve and protect. Because it is part of the training, I think it's kind of antithetical to assume, you know, we can just hire more or better corrections officers, or we can, you know, hire new COs and we can train them out of this proclivity, because COs don't necessarily have a proclivity to violence. It's the prison environment that does.
So what I'm learning is that the silver bullet solution just getting that ratio right to hit that equilibrium between COs and prisoners is not the solution that we're looking for. But as you had mentioned earlier, a way to get there also is to decarcerate, lower the prison population. And I'm just curious, where do you start that conversation? And what could that look like in a place like Wisconsin?
The good news and bad news in Wisconsin is the same, which is Wisconsin has not taken a lot of the most obvious steps towards reducing its prison population by releasing people. It's one of a very few states that doesn't have a good time system. And good time is this program that can allow people to earn time off of their sentences for good behavior or for participating in programs. Almost every state has these programs. Wisconsin does not. Wisconsin is one of 16 states that's effectively abolished discretionary parole. A lot of people will be surprised to hear this because, you know, I think you're often hearing about this or that person being paroled or the parole board coming to a decision about someone. But that actually only applies to a very small number of people in Wisconsin who were sentenced before the year 2000. Everybody sentenced today does not have the opportunity to earn early release from the parole board. Wisconsin also is a state that has gotten very bad grades from organizations like Families Against Mandatory Minimums, which has noted problems with their medical parole system and their compassionate release system. So compassionate release, which is a way that states can release people who are nearing death or have an illness that makes them so disabled that they are unlikely to pose a threat to the community. This system in Wisconsin is not very robust. I just listed three there. I know that was already kind of a lot, but the bad news is that a lot of people in Wisconsin prisons are suffering from this lack of avenues for early release. The good news is that there are a lot of steps that the state can take.
For me, a lot of what we do on this show is sharing stories. So much of systemic change rests in public opinion as well. And I'm just wondering, how would you get people who are scared of those words or don't understand what happens within inside of a prison system to kind of lean into and to be more curious about the ideas and the research that your team has done?
I mean, I definitely think that individual stories are important. There are things that you just can't quite become comfortable with until you've put yourself in someone else's shoes. It's kind of popular these days to lean on the idea of the non-violent, you know, non-serious offender, maybe looking exclusively at drug offenses. I would say that's one way to approach this. I would say that that's a strategy that sort of falls short of what I think most people are capable of in terms of compassion. If you talk to people about incarcerated folks as individuals, and you talk about the systemic injustices as a society that have led us to incarcerate so many people, the criminalization of poverty, the racism in the justice system, both of which are so well pronounced in Wisconsin, I think you're able to get people to understand how releasing people with robust reentry systems that can help them get back on their feet is actually not just a humane idea, but actually, you know, it's a good idea. The other thing that I guess I would say is that most people, you know, and I say this, but I know it's, you know, this talking point's been rinsed, but I'm still going to say it. Most people, and upwards of 90% of people who are in prison will come home someday. If you look at it from that kind of a rational perspective, it's hard not to see how decarceration is essential and how it's important.
That was Wanda Bertram from the Prison Policy Initiative. She spoke with Lake Effect's Jimmy Gutierrez. Surgeon General Dr. Vivek Murthy has issued a first-of-its-kind advisory declaring gun violence a national public health crisis. Colleen Trevino is a nurse practitioner at Frederick and the Medical College and the director of the Trauma Quality of Life Clinic. She's treated trauma patients for over 20 years, many of them for firearm injuries. The clinic takes a holistic approach to treating those affected by gun violence. Trevino will be a speaker at UW-Milwaukee's upcoming Trauma in Our Community conference. But ahead of that, she joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to share more about healing trauma as a public health priority.
Can you share what typically happens to people who have experienced a firearm injury from violence or anything like that that comes through your doors in the healthcare setting?
Yeah, so kind of how it all works is patients are either dropped off or come in via ambulance. They're seen in the trauma bay. All of the trauma team is alerted. In the trauma team, we have a trauma surgeon. We have various levels of surgical residents. We have nurse practitioners and physician assistants. We have trauma specialty nurses, and we have the emergency department group, which is an emergency department physician residents, and then the nurses. And so once we have a trauma activation, everybody comes to the bed and we do a primary secondary survey, which is look at the patient, look for their injuries, and then come up with a quick plan on how to evaluate those injuries, whether it's a CT scan or go to the operating room. Sometimes people will get some procedures in the trauma bay, like a chest tube. And sometimes we will do bedside operations if it's an emergency. Once they go to either the OR, then they might go to the ICU or the inpatient unit. If they're sick enough, they'll go to the ICU. ICU is a trauma specialty unit. So our nurses and advanced practice providers will care for the patients while they're in the ICU. Then they can be transferred to our trauma unit. So we have a specialty trauma unit, which also has a step-down component for a little bit sicker patients with specialty trauma nurses that care for them as they recover after their injuries.
So a bunch of support and resources are activated quickly, but for after the patient is treated and they're deemed healthy enough to go home, is there much support or a system that they can lean back on?
So the other thing that we are really fortunate in having is we have a trauma psychology program here. So we screen everybody for depression, anxiety, and post-traumatic stress disorder, the risk of. And if they screen high, they are actually seen by our trauma psychologists while they're inpatient. Once they go home, we send them home with all the directions on how to care for their wounds and how to take their medicines. But as you can imagine, it's extremely overwhelming. Also, not necessarily having a lot of additional resources when they go home, and us as hospital providers not knowing what all of those additional resources are. And I think the big change in our system really was the addition of our hospital-based violence interrupter program, which is Form for Life. Really, their focus is to prevent the cycle of violence and prevent any additional violence because of the injury. And what they also do for us is provide a credible messenger. And so they are really able to connect us with our patients and provide a bridge of trust to let our patients really know that we do care and we do want to help them get better, and we want to protect them as well so they don't get re-injured. The other two pieces are our community pieces. So we have violence interrupters in the community that can go to the neighborhoods and prevent that cycle of violence. And then we also have an outreach group that that can help with resources as well. So that really changed our ability to connect with our patients. And then at the same time, we really wanted to develop this multidisciplinary follow-up clinic, which we started in November of 2020. So we put it together so that we would have all the pieces to ensure that we were addressing all the biopsychosocial needs of our patients. So there's me as the nurse practitioner who manages their wounds and their pain. Then they see our trauma psychologist, so that whether they saw them in the hospital and or had anything set up outpatient, oh, it's always a check-in. They will see our trauma social worker to determine if there's any additional resources they need, such as issues with housing, issues with getting food. Then they will also follow up with our physical therapist so we can ensure that they're progressing like they need to physically. And then, of course, they'll follow up with our 414 Life hospital-based violence interrupter, once again, as a check-in, and then also to determine if they need to hand them off to the community group as well. Then we developed a nurse navigator program, and they would be that connection and that person that they know so that when they go home, if they have any questions, they know somebody and they know that person that they can contact. And I think that has once again really helped bridge that gap between discharge and going home. And this is the only program in the nation like it.
So with the Trauma Quality of Life Clinic, when did you make the transition from treating trauma patients to then studying it as it continues to impact patients, right? Because from what I understand, with your research overall at this clinic, you're working on quantifying trauma and inequity to then mitigate disparities in the future, right?
Yeah, I mean, we do know that our patients who are injured by firearm and violence do have worse chronic pain, a more depression, more post-traumatic stress disorder, or long-term quality of life outcomes. And so we have verified that indeed they are at higher risk. And then also we're looking at currently collecting that data longitudinally so that once again, we can verify that this patient population is at extreme risk for these poor quality of life outcomes. And that's the research that we continue to do.
What are some of the challenges of research that assesses individuals who are recently traumatized?
Well, I'll tell you, I think we get really good responses from our patients. They want to help out. They want to participate. They want to, you know, help document some of the issues that are going on with this patient population, which is typically the majority are young Black men. 80% are young Black men, and they want to help us identify their patient population and what interventions really can work for them in order to heal over time. So we don't get a whole lot of concerns from the patient's perspective about participating in research. And I think once again, developing the trust in the beginning mitigates a lot of that mistrust with research as well.
Taking a healing approach to trauma, having this approach as a public health priority, is this a relatively new concept in the medical and humanities fields?
It isn't. However, I will tell you it is new in trauma care. In the past, it is about saving a life and mortality and the trauma bay. But, you know, when we save a life, we have to remember that, you know, patients can have long-term disabilities, whether it's physical or mental. And we have to be responsible for ensuring that our patients recover to the best of their ability. And we have to support that. And I think we can take lessons learned from cancer care and neurosurgery and neurology care that it's not a new idea. It's just applying it to the disease of trauma, which is what we need to once again refocus our thoughts about. It's not just about this injury or this you know, gunshot wound to the chest or this broken arm. It's about everything that goes along with the experience. And so it definitely needs to be refocused into a public health model.
So can you share some of the strategies that you and the team have developed in order to improve the well-being and recovery of the individuals who have experienced firearm injuries that come through the clinic?
It is about setting a culture of mutual respect, of showing that we do care. And we ask all the questions now. I'll tell you, 20 years ago, I didn't ask questions about, are you, you know, having nightmares? Are you coming out of your house? Are you feeling safe? Because I couldn't address any of those issues. Now we address all those issues and we ask all the questions. And so I think just treating people as humans and then letting them understand that they can ask us anything and we will try to work to resolve some of those problems the best as we can.
I imagine there's more work to be done for many other places, you know, Milwaukee and beyond, to see trauma as a public health priority. But in your opinion, with the work you've done and the experiences you've had, what's the first step to help other medical professionals and organizations to start thinking in this lens?
We're out on the road all the time. We do a lot of presentations at our professional organizations, our trauma organizations. And I think everybody is really drinking the Kool-Aid, but the concern they have is, you know, how do you get something like this started? And you just have to be real persistent. You have to have, I hate to say it, you have to have the right people, because if you don't have those people who are willing to push and do the work and talk to all the players who can actually make it happen, you just won't get anywhere. And you have to focus on what you can do and then just incrementally add to it.
Colleen Trevino is a nurse practitioner and associate professor of surgery at the Medical College of Wisconsin and the director of the Trauma Quality of Life Clinic. She joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski ahead of UW-Milwaukee's Trauma in Our Community conference, where she'll be a speaker. You can find more information about the conference at wuwm.com. In about 15 minutes, we'll bring you a new Family Recipes, a series where we visit the kitchens of local residents who share their beloved family cooking traditions.
I thought, well, this is the way she does it, and I've got the gospel here, only to find out that, you know, next year she's telling it to somebody else in a different way and changing this ingredient and that. And well, what's the real way to make this?
We'll tell you all about Polish pastry made for the holidays. But first, we'll explore some of the best places to eat this summer in Milwaukee, from sausage to taco trucks to the best cold brew. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. It's summertime in Milwaukee, which means there is a lot to do outdoors, like concerts, festivals, and dining. Anne Christensen covers dining for Milwaukee Magazine. For this month's issue, she wrote about some of the best sausages, taco trucks, and summer drinks in the city. Lake Effect's Excrit Nunez is joined by Christensen to learn more.
I love that there's a little bit of everything in this month's dining section, but I have to say the sausage feature really stood out to me. What inspired you to highlight this summer staple?
Well, if you live in Milwaukee and you don't eat sausage, then you have not truly lived. I mean, Milwaukee is known for sausage. Obviously, the bratwurst is very popular here. But we're also known for a lot of other different kinds of sausages. And some of it comes from the city's German ancestry. So I think sausage is such a fascinating food. It's cool to me that people are really into it and that it's such a staple in the summer and at baseball games. And it was a thing when they filmed the Top Chef season 21 in Milwaukee at AmFam Field. So it's just, I don't know, sausage is just part of the fabric of who we are.
And so you showcase 8 different sausages for this feature. Which one is your favorite?
Ooh, that's tough. I've always really loved a good Italian sausage. I also really love chorizo. But chorizo is interesting because there are different kinds of chorizo. There's a Spanish chorizo and there's a Mexican chorizo, and they're very different from one another. But I love really highly seasoned sausages, so I would gravitate in those directions.
Yeah, and I love how you were like, you haven't lived if you haven't had. I haven't lived, Anne. I haven't lived. There are quite a few sausages on the list that I haven't tried. Like, I've never heard of a bockwurst before.
Isn't that wild?
That one was pretty interesting to me.
I have to say, though, what was interesting to me when I was doing this, like the terminology for a hot dog, to some people, it's an all beef Frankfurter or Wiener or whatever. But if you go to Germany, a German Frankfurter is technically always made from pork. Now, if you shop for hot dogs or Frankfurters in the store, you will find sausages made with a mix of different meats. So I was learning stuff when I was researching these sausages because I just assumed, you know, an all beef hot dog. Okay, well, that's what we got. No, there are different versions of that. I was just going to say the Bockwurst and the Knackwurst are these German sausages you just don't even hear about. But if you go to Usinger's, which is just an institution in Milwaukee, they make those sausages.
Yeah, I was going to say, tell me a few places that I can shop for the best sausages.
Okay, well, I have to say Usinger's is one of them. They've been around for many, many, many years. And they're located down on 3rd Street. And it's a really cool store because you go in and it's super old world. And they have all these different kinds of sausages to choose from. And they know everything about sausage. So, I mean, you can just ask them any question and they have the answer to it. And they also have really unusual things like blood sausage, which, you know, you don't think people really eat that anymore. And maybe not the average person does, but many people really, I mean, that's like a cultural thing for them. So Usinger's for sure is a place to shop. I also really love, you know, if you want something, a place that's a little bit more of a modern butcher shop, Bevette down in the 3rd Ward, which is also a restaurant, but they also do a lot of in-house made sausages. So if you go in there, they may have things like an Italian, a Polish sausage, a brat, they could have a lamb sausage. So if you're looking for something a little bit different, a bit more modern, Bevette is a really fun place to check out.
Well, I'll definitely have to make a trip out of visiting Usinger's or Bevette. I'm looking forward to all my sausage needs there. So another delicious guide you included in this summer's dining section really highlights taco trucks, but specifically five taco trucks. Tell me about the ones that rise to the top for you.
I focused in on five really great ones. And there's one truck that I really, really like that's on the south side. It's called Ilagitsa Oaxaca. They have wonderful pastor tacos and asada. I found that when I was going to a lot of the taco trucks that I was always kind of falling back on the pastor and the asada, the steak. They're just really good. This particular truck has a dish that they call alambre, just this wonderful dish of like, it's almost like stewed meat. And it has melted cheese on top and avocado. And it comes in kind of like a platter and it can feed probably, I mean, easily 4 people. And they give you tortillas with it and a little like a blistered chili pepper and a roasted potato. And you've got your salsas. You can make tacos out of this. It's absolutely delicious. So that's a really great truck. There's another one on a totally different side of town. It's called El Taco Valiz, I believe. And I had tacos there, but I found that they make these really great quesadillas with corn tortillas. And I'm convinced that the corn tortillas are handmade there because they just taste fresh. So I found that to be really, really great. But, you know, all these places that I feature in here had just really good tacos.
And I love that you mentioned earlier that you possibly could write an opus on Milwaukee taco trucks.
Yes. Yes.
That's really special that we can do that here. You also highlight a few treats people can cool down with this summer, but you specifically highlight one ice cream shop. Tell me about it.
Yeah, Joy Ice Cream Social is about the most charming ice cream place that I have been to in a really long time. And it is this adorable little house that's painted white and blue and has a walk-up window, and the outside has, you know, has seating, and it's really, you know, kind of, it just looks so welcoming. And then if you don't want to go up to the walk-up window, you can go inside and it's absolutely adorable inside. You know, you can go in and get a cone, you can get a shake. They also have like lemonades, and I think they even have like grown-up beverages if you want something like that. But there is something about the mystique of this place that draws people in. It's just so cute. It's so well done. And the ice cream is great. I don't know. It's just, it's kind of like my new favorite little place.
And something else that's refreshing is cold brew. You highlight four coffee shops that do it best, but what makes cold brew the go-to summer coffee drink?
First of all, cold brew can be differentiated from just iced coffee because iced coffee is just brewed coffee that is cooled and put over ice and is typically really weak and watery. Cold brew is made from a concentrate and it's bold and it's juicy and it's bright. And usually cold brews are made from like a dark roast bean, can be a little bit fruity, but oftentimes ones that have like deep, dark chocolate notes. So it's really rich and boldly, beautifully flavored. And so that's another story I had a lot of fun doing because I am such an avid cold brew drinker. And I did find that a lot of places it is really different. You know, in the story, I mentioned that there's this one location of Stone Creek Coffee that's in Whitefish Bay, and they always have several different ones available. So I always say to people that, you know, if you want a cold brew that is just a little bit different and has just so many interesting flavors that you can just kind of discover, that's a great way to do it. And I would love to see more cafes doing interesting roasts like that. But I also really like, there's a place on the east side, just north of downtown called Interval. And they just have a wonderful, smooth, beautifully tart cold brew. You just add a little bit of half and half to it, and it's just perfection. But yeah, I find cold brew to be really refreshing and satisfying.
Well, Anne, thank you so much for speaking with me today. You made me really excited for my first Milwaukee summer.
Well, you're very welcome. This was really fun.
Anne Christensen is the dining editor at Milwaukee Magazine. She spoke with Lake Effect's expert Nunez. You can find Christensen's summer dining guide in this month's issue of Milwaukee Magazine. Still to come, we'll learn about a traditional Polish pastry made around the holidays. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Polish immigrants and their ancestors helped create the Milwaukee we know today. Thousands immigrated to the city post-Civil War and helped shape much of what we see on the city's south side. Lake Effect contributor Lucian Young shares a traditional Polish dish in family recipes. He visits the kitchens of local residents who share their beloved family recipes that they remember from childhood. In this episode, Eva Barczyk and her husband, Neil Pease, share their family's recipe for the traditional Polish pastry, Makowiec.
It's a prominent feature at Polish Christmases and Easter. Yeah. And one of the reasons is poppies, because poppy seeds are used in all kinds of dishes that we make for the holiday. And, you know, the tradition is that poppies, the flowers, grew where Jesus's blood fell during crucifixion. So Christmas, Easter, resurrection, and all of that. So it ties in with that. And poppies are believed to bring prosperity and good luck. So we use poppies liberally. But this is a prominent dessert during the holidays. It's very labor intensive. So we make it only for Christmas, but you go to any Polish deli, you will find it all the time, like a miniature version of this. When we find those at the Polish deli, you know, we buy them and eat them for breakfast.
Poppy seeds seem like they'd be really difficult to work with. I've seen them just in their seed form. And what are you doing? You're grinding them down. And how do you get that texture that's making this creamy filling?
Well, traditionally, in the old days, go buy the poppy seeds. And then it's labor intensive. You're cooking it. You're grinding it several times and all of that. We don't do it that way. And my mom, who was from Poland, learned very quickly that that's one step you can eliminate and buy the canned solo, was the solo poppy seed filling. That was the common one. We use two cans of that. But nowadays we go to a Polish deli and there's three of them in Milwaukee and they're three good ones. We buy the Polish, imported from Poland, the can, and they already come with some of the sweetening things, but we add more to it. We can never leave things well enough alone, so we improve it.
Okay. During the busy holidays, it's one less thing to worry about.
That's right. And so we just take the poppy seed, a can, we add a little honey, we add chopped almonds, raisins that we've soaked in rum or brandy. And then we whip up the remainder of the egg whites that we didn't use in the cake. And then we fold that in. It keeps it together so it doesn't fall apart.
Using the canned stuff doesn't reduce the quality of it at all. It's not as if doing all the work really makes that much difference, if you don't mind my saying so. Just open the can and
add the stuff.
Yeah.
Well, it seems like this is all about this yeast-based pastry.
Yes, it is. And I think that's why it takes as much time as it does, because you let it rise twice and then after that you bake it. So you have to be kind of babysitting it all day long.
So I'm sorry, there are three different periods in which this dough is rising.
Yes, the initial trying of the yeast and then the two risings. And you kind of need it in advance of that. So it takes some time and some effort.
And then the final raising is in when it's baking. It still increases in size.
I think people are really intimidated by yeast doughs. They don't know if this yeast is, I've heard the term is live. They don't know if it's going to work. Do you just have a sense when you're looking at it after all these years of making it that the dough is right at each stage? Are there any tips you can give?
Well, other people probably do. We've had some failed attempts ourselves that we've had to start over. I mean, yes.
The most common thing is if you heat up the water or milk, we use milk to proof it. We put it in with sugar. And if you don't watch the temperature of your liquid, you will cook your yeast and then you will see that you're not getting bubbles or anything else. We've had attempts where we realize we killed it and it had to run over and buy more yeast.
How many years did it take to actually get this family recipe written down? Tell me a little bit about that process.
Well, let's see. You know, Eva's mom would do it year after year. And
we've been married 50 years, yeah, so... Yeah.
And, you know, we would only bake it occasionally. I think it was, I don't know, 20 years ago, I must have asked her, can you tell me the recipe? And she says, sure. And so we sit down. And as I remember, it wasn't that extensive or anything. It was enough to fill it on a 4x6 index card. And she's dictating to me in Polish and I'm writing it down. And so I thought, well, this is the way she does it. And I've got the gospel here. Only to find out that, you know, next year she's telling it to somebody else in a different way and changing this ingredient and that. And well, now, what's the real way to make this? And the real way to make it is what every Polish grandmother thinks is the way to do it. And that can change from detail to detail, but it tends to end up pretty much the same way.
So you've only been making this for 20 years?
About that. Yeah.
What made you decide to start making this yourself?
Well, I think we liked it. And I think one year I just said, I'm going to try baking it myself. And it didn't go too well.
What went wrong?
It exploded.
But it was delicious.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Exploded.
Well, yeah. You know, you're supposed to roll it and it's supposed to hold its shape. And I don't know, maybe I got too much poppy or whatever. And it simply didn't hold. And so it just kind of, well.
Like a volcano.
Yes.
We had a lot of poppies mm-hmm. filling everywhere.
So it was a trial and error sort of thing. And we've gotten a little better over the years, mainly because I leave it to her.
No, but I think the real impetus to start doing it was really when my mom passed on.
Yeah.
And I'm the oldest of a large family, so I carried on all the cooking traditions. And so that's, and we didn't take us, you know, we have tried about every store-bought Makovyets in the Chicago area. And
with
just
all due respect, it's not the same. Yeah, it's one of those things that's best at home.
I would think that being a yeast dough, it's really important that it be fresh. And so that could play into it as well. I don't know how long they're sitting on the store shelves.
They have dates on them. I mean, you go to Chicago to the delis and, I mean, they turn over every day. So it's not the age. It's just that it's not homemade.
Yeah.
So
the big difference to me about homemade as opposed to store-bought is the store-bought is drier. And when it's homemade and fresh, there's a give to the, it's simply fresher. And for that reason, better.
And more poppy seed filling in it. Yeah. Yeah, we don't skimp on the poppy seed.
How long have you two been cooking together? How did you get into making some of these Polish recipes?
Well, we're both familiar with it. Eva grew up with it, and I've sort of acquired it.
By the way, we met in Poland, even though he's not Polish.
You did? Well, do you mind sharing the story of how you met in Poland?
Sure. This was a while ago. This is back in the early 1970s. And I was attending the University of Kansas, that was the hometown university, and I had gotten interested in East European stuff, and they had a year abroad in a Polish city, and Eva was living in Chicago at the time and was sort of between jobs. What do I do for a year? Maybe I'll go on this. And so we met in Poznań, Poland, and spent a year there and came back and got married shortly thereafter. Did I tell the story right?
Yep.
Do you remember the first thing that you cooked together?
Oh, wow.
We were cooking in Poland together.
Oh,
I remember. We lived in a dormitory, but the food was awful there.
Even by college student standards, you know, it was pretty bad.
So we would buy food, and the guys lived in the guys' dorm. They didn't have we have kitchen facilities in the girls' dorm. So I remember we were making another dessert called faworki or chrusty, which is like angel. They're called angel wings. You fold them through. It takes a lot of kneading and really rolling it out. And I remember he said, well, let me help you with this. And he took the dough, and to knead it, he started throwing it against the wall. And so till today, there's a big spot on that wall in where we lived. But so there were four of us that would be together in Poland, four Americans, and we cook our dinners together.
Well, what accounts for the difference, like adding the sour cream in some recipes? Is that just a difference in the family?
I think it is. Yeah. And, you know, my mom added rum. I'm not sure that that's a standard thing, but my mom always believed that, you know, that made it made the cake a little better. The texture of it was better. And the same way with sour cream.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like, especially with the sour cream, it's all about getting that dough to be very soft.
Yes. Yes. But not sticky. You don't want it sticky.
You recognize the texture of that dough.
Yes, that's right. It's the same way when we make pierogi. The dough has to feel right or it won't stick together. It'll fall apart when you boil it.
And I know you sort of touched on this, but just for those that are going to try and make this, just describe, what does that dough feel like?
Well, you want it to be cohesive and stick together without being sticky. So kind of like a fresh Play-Doh in a way, but softer.
Think of a thicker pizza dough. It's supposed to feel a little bit elastic. It's got a nice glisten to it. And it kind of bends a little bit when you hold it without falling apart. I don't know how to put it anymore.
And now the filling. What is the filling texture?
It's quite thick. Yeah. So it's almost the consistency of peanut butter. But because you spread it over the whole thing. When you take it out of the can, it's really thick.
Yeah.
But by the time you add the raisins that have been soaked and added honey, so that loosens it. And then when you gently fold in the egg whites, that really gives it a lighter consistency, and it's very spreadable. But it still will hold together so that it shouldn't explode.
Did you ever make this for your parents?
No.
No. we wouldn't dare. No.
Oh, they have never tried your...
No, because as
that was
my,
her mom's.
No, well, my dad said, as long as I'm living, we will have Christmas Eve at my house and Christmas at our house. And my mom would cook. My mom outlived my dad by a few years. But so she would, but with our help, you know, with all of my sisters and brothers coming in for Christmas, and we would help my mom do it. And she would never let us go to the store to buy like ready-made. It had to be homemade. And so, no, we never did it for her.
It would have been unthinkable to try to take over the Makoviets from her mom.
Eva Barczyk is the Emerita Director of the UWM Libraries. Her husband, Neil Pease, is an Emeritus Professor of History at UW-Milwaukee. They shared their family recipe with Lake Effect contributor Lucian Young. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. You can also check out WUWM's new politics podcast called Swing State of the Union. It explores why Wisconsin is a deeply purple state and why it's so important in this election year. The 9th episode is out now, and you can find it wherever you like to listen to podcasts. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll learn about Milwaukee Gorilla Gay Bar, where LGBTQ plus people would move into traditionally straight bars on a monthly basis. Plus, we'll explore the health benefits of a good mocktail in this month's Dig In. That's all tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect, on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.